Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The Sustainable Forest Management Network supports research that will not only help us develop a better understanding of forest ecosystems, but also how we can apply that newfound knowledge to reduce our human footprint, be it from logging, agriculture, oil and gas development, or urbanization. One project is called EMEND, and it will last 80 years, and some of the early results already show the importance of beetles in recycling nutrients after a fire. And Dr. Susan Hannon's research looks at woodpeckers that follow the beetles into recently burned areas. Both these studies have implications for how we deal with fire suppression and salvage logging. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Imagine starting an experiment that won't be finished until long after your own death. Well, that's what the people who started the EMEND project are facing. EMEND is the largest and longest research project initiated by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, and the acronym is short for Ecosystem Management Emulating Natural Disturbance. The natural disturbances that shape our forest landscape and biodiversity are fire, insects, and disease. The question is, can logging be done in such a way that it mimics what nature does in the forest? Dr. John Spence is a professor and chair of the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta. He is one of the leaders of EMEND.
We're mainly trying to see how we could best emulate the effects of fire, insects and disease, and blowdown on the landscape. So we're really interested in the natural pathways of succession in an undisturbed forest, or let's say a natural forest that is disturbed by natural events, and how important, say, initiation by fire, how important the coarse woody material on the ground is, how important all those things are to the kind of forest that eventually develops. And our goal is to see if we can't help forest managers to better harvest and regenerate their forests, to preserve those processes, to keep the habitats there, to keep the nutrient cycling on track, to keep the basis for sustained productivity in the forest.
This project's been going on for a little while. Where have you sited it?
It's sited about 100 kilometers northwest of Peace River, Alberta. It takes about an hour and a half to get there. The roads are not that great. But it's right at the edge of where forests are being harvested in that part of the province. So it's in forests that have never seen the feller buncher before. And it was a very good system for us to work in.
When you get into that site, what exactly are you doing? How have you set up this research project?
The project is set up as a series of innovative harvesting treatments where what we have done is to leave variable amounts of residual material behind in four different cover types. We've worked in spruce, in aspen with a spruce understory, and in mixed wood stands, which are combinations of both spruce and aspen. And then in each of those cover types, we have left 2% residual, 10% residual, 20%, 50%, and 70% residual. And we're then following the recovery of the forest under those different situations and then trying to compare what happens in each of those situations with what happens in stands that are burned in the same area.
What are some of the things that you found out so far?
Well, one of the more interesting results, I think, one of the big picture results, is that regardless of which part of the biota we look at, whether it's the plants, the insects, or the birds in that system, it appears that once you harvest more than about 50% of the forest, those groups all respond in roughly the same ways. In other words, there's going to be, once you've opened up the forest by more than half, there are quite enormous effects on the biota. This suggests that the variable retention harvest is not going to give us very much in terms of instant lifeboat effects, which is the idea that we preserve species kind of there unimpeded. Perhaps bigger clumps of residual would be better because our retention is distributed. In other words, it's all across the block rather than in big clumps. But I'm leaning towards feeling that leaving bigger pieces of unharvested forest that are really important to lifeboat species on the landscape. It tells us also that what we have to be looking at is how these species recover and how the processes associated with those species, such as nutrient cycling and so on, recover over time. And we're hopeful that we'll find some good results and that there'll be some combinations of harvest and silviculture effects that give us something very similar to the same kind of end and process as we see after wildfire. But that's we're a little too early now to say very much about that.
It seems like there's an awful lot of research going on by all kinds of different groups that are looking at these same kinds of issues. How does what you're doing differ or enhance what other projects are going on?
I think that's a really good question. And what we feel the great strength of eMEND is its size and its common land base. We have an experiment that absorbs about 1,000 hectares of land. It's a very large-scale experiment. We believe it's, if not the largest, certainly one of the largest forest manipulative experiments in the world. But it brings together on one site people working on everything from, you know, mosses and understory plants to insects in the understory, in the canopy, to birds, to bats, to nutrient cycling, to hydrology, all together on one site making use of the same sets of plots. So we can ask the really important questions for the kinds of social decisions that we need to make is what are the trade-offs between preserving biodiversity and harvest costs? What are the trade-offs between preserving biodiversity and future productivity, between productivity and nutrient cycling? All of these things that have relationships with each other that are usually studied by single labs in isolation. And then you try to get those studies together and you find that there's so many factors that make it impossible for you to get the integrative result because they're conducted in different places. At eMEND, it's all being done in the same place using one large unified approach and a common database. So we'll actually be able to get at those questions that are of pressing importance for social decision-making.
You talked about emulating the disturbance through fire and insects. And fire, you can see, well, it burns the trees down, and logging, it takes the trees away. But how do insects fit into that?
Well, I think most people probably don't understand how many species of insects there are in our forests and what their hugely diverse roles are. There are thousands of species of insects, literally, in our forests, and they do all sorts of things. And there are many species, or there are some species that we think of as pests who can tackle big pieces of forest land and either severely affect the trees, or sometimes in the case of things like mountain pine beetle in British Columbia now, or spruce beetle in the Alberta North, actually kill the trees. Spruce budworm can do this as well over a long period of time. And those trees create gaps. Now, all the time in our forests, we have insects and diseases. I take the two of them together, attacking individual trees. If you go into the forest, there's always trees that have died all over the place, standing dead snags and logs. Why do those trees die? They die mainly through the action of insects and diseases. So insects and diseases are a constant disturbance acting in the forest to open up little gaps and allow the forest to diversify and get richer. In the ecological literature, that's called gap dynamics. And it's a part of producing these very complex old forests that in the early days of thinking about forest management, we have really quite forgotten about. That's what makes a forest different from a plantation. It's the existence of these gap dynamic processes. And that's why when we designed eMEND, we were very careful that we wanted to maintain some aspect of distributed retention over the landscape so that we could build in some aspect of this kind of dynamic into what we did as a kind of a backbone. And we think that's maybe one of the things that's been missing in some of the other work that's been done is that it hasn't seen that gap dynamic process as a fundamental underlying aspect of what happens in forests. So insects cause those gaps, Insects and diseases working together cause those gaps, and also many, many species of insects take advantage of the dead wood that's brought down in those gaps, so-called saprozoic species which either live in or feed on dead and decaying wood, are among the most threatened species anywhere in the world from forestry.
Now, why are they threatened?
Because in most systems where we've practiced forestry for a long time, we've removed huge amounts of dead wood from the system, and we've taken away their habitats. Very classic studies done in Sweden and Finland both show that these species end up on the red list time after time after time after time. They have more moose in Sweden and Finland now than they ever had before. The things that are threatened in their system are the big predators, which were basically have been killed by people who didn't like big predators on the landscape. The thing that forestry has impacted most have been saprozoic insects, things that depended on that element of habitat that's been taken away as the forests have been simplified as a result of forestry.
You've been at this now since about 97, 98. How much further do you have to go?
I hate to chuckle a little bit here, but when we set this experiment up, explicit intention of our sponsors is to run this project for a full rotation. That means that they have locked up this piece of the land for 80 years. I won't be around to see the results in the end. I'm sure hopeful that with another 10 or 15 years of work, which is about what I have to put into it myself, that we'll actually begin to see some really interesting results. But of course, at that time, the experiment is 5 years old now. At the most, I'm going to see it 20 years after harvest. Surely we'll have some interesting information, but it won't be the whole story. Now, I know a lot of people are impatient, and they suggest that, well, you know, this is way too long a time frame because we need the information now, we're cutting the forest now. My answer to those people is that if 70 years ago someone had had the foresight to set up such an experiment as we have now, we would have some pretty powerful and good answers that we could rely on. No one did. Now, 80 years from now, when we get to the end of EMEND, this experiment, this experience will be of enormous value to people who follow along behind us. And we believe it can help us learn as we go. It will suggest ideas for doing things differently. In fact, we have a couple of them already, of new things that we're going to try, that were inspired by what we found at EMEND. But there are kind of two time scales that you have to think about. One is the time scale that you expect to make little improvements in what you're doing. And there's a time scale where you expect something to have a major impact in how you think about things. The major impact of EMEND will come long after I'm dead and gone, I'm sure. But the fact is that as we go every year, I think we're able to come up with little suggestions and ideas that help us improve things, that give us new ideas to try, to test out, and so on. And those are very valuable as well.
Thank you very much, John.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
That was Dr. John Spence, a professor and chair of the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta. And he is a co-leader of EMEND, a research project sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Sharing the leadership role with John is Dr. Jan Volney, a research scientist with the Canadian Forest Service.
One of the missions of the Canadian Forest Service, of course, is to manage forests sustainably. And so it's vital that we see what the trade-offs are between, you know, preserving or conserving biodiversity and integrity of these systems, together with the ability to sustain the productivity of these forests.
What are some of the things that you're looking at?
I'm interested in the productivity. What sort of factors influence the productivity of these forests when they're unharvested and when they're harvested. And I think it's pretty exciting to see this sort of thing done on a fairly large scale, looking at a whole successional sequence of stands from, you know, the pioneering communities of aspen to the spruce-dominated stands that are pretty close to the culmination of the natural system.
What does the CFS bring to this?
Well, we have a long history of forestry research. We've anticipated a lot of problems in doing our research and making forestry and forest management feasible in Canada in today's world. We hope we'll continue to do that. So we have a cadre of research scientists and technicians and technically skilled people that can bring their skills to bear on the problems that we're looking at here. We also provide opportunities for students to come and work in our labs and use our research collections, museums, libraries, and this sort of thing to further enhance their university experience. And I think that's very valuable because we're in an 80-year project. We have to think of succession. It's just like a succession of trees. The old ones will fall down. We'll be dead and gone before the end of this experiment. People like Josh will take over the reins of a project like this and sustain it and hopefully provide some answers that we desperately need.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
That was Dr. Jan Volney, a research scientist with the Canadian Forest Service and a co-leader of EMAND, a research project supported by the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Since EMAND is designed to last a full forest rotation, a period of 80 years, John Spence and Jan Volney will be depending on the next generation of researchers to carry the torch. Josh Jacobs is a graduate student at the University of Alberta who's been studying the ecological significance of beetles as part of the EMAND project.
I'm working on a group of beetles known as saprozoic beetles. Those are beetles that are attracted to dead and decaying wood, and they either use it for some part of their life cycle or they feed on it.
What's the question you're researching?
Well, with this group of beetles, I'm looking at the beetle communities in undisturbed forests, and then looking how that beetle community changes when disturbances occur, such as wildfire or forest harvest.
Now, how do you go about this? I see you have some traps and even some beetles with you today.
Yeah, there's quite a few different methods I use for collecting beetles in the forest. The one I mainly use is known as a flight intercept trap or a window trap, and that's just basically hanging a piece of plexiglass on the side of a tree that the beetles might be attracted to, and then as the beetles are coming to that tree, they'll hit the plexiglass, fall through a funnel into a collecting jar. Another common trap I used is a pitfall trap, which is just basically a yogurt container buried flush in the ground, and that'll catch lots of the beetles that are just running along on the ground, and they happen to fall in the trap. A third trap I use is known as a Lindgren funnel trap, and it's just a series of funnel hung between trees, anywhere from about between 8 and 12 funnels, and it's usually baited with either a pheromone given off by the beetles or of the tree, and the beetles will fly towards this series of funnels, and it'll look kind of like a tree to a beetle. They'll hit one funnel, they'll fall through the rest of them into a collecting jar at the bottom.
What do these beetles do? What's their role in the forest?
Many of these beetles have important roles in nutrient cycling and decomposition, because many of them feed on the fungus that decomposes the dead trees. As well, many of them feed on each other. There's predators that'll feed on the fungivores as well. So they're important in helping return the nutrients in the dead trees back into the soil to allow a new crop of trees to grow.
What are some of the things that could impede them from doing that?
Well, one of the biggest things that impacts these beetles is during forest harvest, we remove a great deal of the wood from the landscape, which depletes the amount of coarse woody material that these beetles have to feed on the ground. So once we're missing this coarse woody material, we also lose the fungus that's decomposing that, as well as the beetles that are aiding in the physical and chemical decomposition of those trees.
You have some beetles here. This guy has very long antennae on that.
Well, this is a cerambycid beetle, or also known as a longhorn beetle. It's the white-spotted sawyer beetle. This is a native beetle in Alberta, and it's one of the beetles that burrows into the middle of trees as larvae, and then they come out as adults, and they're quite large, impressive beetles. Quite often, these kinds of beetles are associated with pests because they do burrow into these trees, but people should remember that most of these beetles do not actually kill the trees. Usually they attack dead and dying trees. These ones in particular are really attracted to trees that have been burnt by fire.
What's this other beetle?
This beetle is Plotinus decentus. I don't believe it has a common name that I know of. It's an aspen specialist beetle. Although we find it throughout the forest, we find it mainly in the aspen stands, where it does quite well. And even during forest harvest, we can take away quite a number of the trees and not really affect these beetles. Whereas when we look at this group of beetles in a conifer stand, where they're not specialized, even a little bit amount of cutting, we'll notice large decreases in the amount of these beetles that we find there.
Thank you very much, Josh.
You're welcome.
That was Josh Jacobs, a graduate student in biological sciences at the University of Alberta. He's researching beetles as part of the EMAN project for the Sustainable Forest Management Network. I also spoke with the project leaders, Dr. John Spence and Dr. Jan Volney. Just as beetles are attracted to recently burned areas to forage on the dead and dying trees, so are woodpeckers. They feed on the beetles and their larvae. In another study supported by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Dr. Susan Hannon and her graduate student Jeff Hoyt looked at the association between woodpeckers, beetles, and recently burned forest habitat.
Well, we were quite interested in looking at the habitat requirements of a couple of species of woodpeckers that have been thought to be burn specialists or fire specialists. So we were interested in finding out what sorts of habitats they were found in, whether they were just in burns or whether they were also in mature and old growth forest, and how long did they persist in these burns after the fire had finished. And also what sorts of trees they foraged on, and what were they selecting, and what the potential impacts of salvage logging might be on this species.
Whereabouts did you conduct the study?
The study was conducted by my grad student, Jeff Hoyt, up in the Mariana Lakes fire, which is south of Fort McMurray.
Well, that's another one of those really large fires that we had just a few years ago.
Yeah, it was a huge fire, and it went right across the highway there. So there was a very large area that was burned.
How did you go about studying this?
So what we did is we went into the fire and we used forest inventory maps from previous to the fire and identified stands of different types of conifer, spruce, pine, and so on. And then we went in and conducted playback. So we have tape recordings of woodpeckers drumming and calling, and then these were played at sampling stations throughout the burns. And then when the birds called back, we were able to identify them and then note that they were there or not there. And so we were able to sample fires, that fire, and then we also sampled mature timber. So this would be stands that were about 80 years of age, and also old growth, so 100-year-plus stands. And then in the second year, Jeff went out and located some other burns of different ages. So we had burns that were 1 year post-fire all the way up to 17 years post-fire. And we censused those burns in the same way using the playbacks to see if the woodpeckers were there or not.
What is the relationship between the birds and the beetles?
Well, the two species of woodpecker we worked on are blackback woodpeckers, and they burrow into the or drill into the trees to get wood-boring larvae of insects. And the other species is a three-toed woodpecker, and it scales the bark off and gets bark beetles. And so these insects are attracted to dead and dying trees, and so apparently they're able to detect some sort of smell of dead and dying trees, including fire plumes, and they can come from very long distances and colonize these burned areas and get into the trees, and so the insect abundance is very, very high in very recent burns.
How quickly after a fire does this recolonization start?
Oh, it can start within probably weeks after a fire, within weeks, yes. It's very fast.
Are there any differences in the way the two different woodpeckers use that tree or what they need? What are their needs from those trees?
Mm-hmm. Well, generally, both species are foraging on burned conifer trees, generally not foraging on deciduous trees. So they're foraging on things like jack pine and spruce. They're similar in the sense that they both forage on fairly large diameter trees, and they forage on those that are a little bit burned but still have enough bark on them so that there are bark beetles underneath. They just differ slightly in their foraging strategy. So as I mentioned earlier, the three-toed woodpecker scales off the bark. So trees that are lightly burned that still have most of their bark on them are preferred by these by this species because the bark beetles are under the bark and they can scale and flake off the pieces of bark and get access to these bark beetles. The blackbacked can actually drill further into the bark to get at some of these wood-boring insects. So they are able to perhaps access more prey that way. So when my student Jeff, looked mainly at blackback woodpeckers, and he again found that generally the trees had to have a certain amount of bark, over 50% of their bark left on them, and they were generally seemed to prefer lightly burned or moderately burned jack pine trees for some reason. So, yeah, so they have sort of slightly different niches, but they're both kind of choosing a similar kind of tree to work on.
This is just two species of woodpeckers, but there's lots of other birds and animals that and plants mm-hmm. that need this post-fire habitat. How does your work, or how does this work, fit into the bigger scheme of things in terms of how we view fire and perhaps how we have to change our perspective on these things?
Yeah, so certainly there have been a few studies done by the Alberta Research Council that has compared recently logged stands to recently burned stands. And they found very large differences in plant communities and animal communities. And in particular, there was a study by Jim Sheik and Hobson, who found that the bird communities are quite different. And although they end up converging at about 25 years after disturbance, initially they're quite different. So I think what it tells us is that really there's large communities of organisms, plants and animals, that seem to do very well after fires, and that you are not going to be able to mimic the effect of fire by clear-cut logging. It's just not going to happen. So I think that in that sense, it's very consistent with some of the other results that have been found in people that have looked at recently burned stands.
Well, when you look for the answer for one question, it always seems to bring up more questions. What does this work lead to?
Well, I think one of the intriguing things about the work is that this might, blackback woodpecker, for example, might be a species that varies quite a bit in its population size depending on the frequency of burns on the landscape. So it can persist at low levels in old growth forest, but then it bounces back whenever there's a burn. So the question that we would like to know is, how do fire-associated species find recent burns? So how do they detect them? How big does a burn have to be in order to attract animals and plants into it? And how far away can they be detected from? So those are some of the things that are interesting. But also from a management perspective, you might want to ask how many burned trees are required, for example, that you should leave in stands that you might want to partially salvage log? Or are there ways that you can use prescribed burning on cut blocks, for example, to create habitat? So you need to know how many burned trees do you need per cut block? What's their spatial arrangement? And issues like how much should these trees be burned and what kind of supply do you need to keep a breeding woodpecker, for example, there? So those are just some of the interesting questions. And on a larger scale is how does the pattern of burning that we see historically, how would that affect the population dynamics of a species like the blackback woodpecker that exists so and can presumably move over very large spatial scales?
Thank you very much, Sue.
You're quite welcome.
That was Dr. Susan Hannon, a professor of biological sciences at the University of Alberta. This woodpecker study for the Sustainable Forest Management Network was recently published in the Canadian Journal of Forest Research. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Capital Region Innovation Center, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Ingenuity, the University of Lethbridge, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, True North Energy, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.